Radio.ie hosts the Irish History Show podcast because history matters. Radio turns 100 years young this year. Radio's history is powered by Radio Archives. For radio archiving solutions from people passionate about radio, visit radio.ie.
Hello and welcome to the Irish History Show. My name is Cathal Brennan, and as always, I'm joined by my co-presenter, John Dorney, from theirishstory.com. Please check out our friends at radio.ie for all your radio archiving solutions. You can find this episode and all our previous episodes on our website, irishhistoryshow.ie. You can follow us on Twitter, at Irish History Pod, or on Facebook, facebook.com/theirishhistoryshow. If you get a chance, please rate and review the show on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. It really does help us. And if you hear an episode you like, please share it on social media. We are really grateful for all the support we receive from you, the listeners. John has set up a Patreon for The Irish Story and The Irish History Show. And if you would consider supporting the show, there is a link in the show notes. Thank you very much. Now, on this episode, we are very pleased to be joined by Dr. Edward Burke, Assistant Professor in the History of War since 1945 at University College Dublin. Among his recent books are An Army of Tribes, British Army Cohesion, Deviancy and Murder in Northern Ireland, and Ulster's Lost Counties, Loyalism and Paramilitarism since 1920. Now, on today's show, we will be discussing Ed's new book, Ghosts of a Family, Ireland's Most Infamous Unsolved Murder, the Outbreak of the Civil War, and the Origins of the Modern Troubles. Ed, you're very welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. Cheers, Kyle. Thanks, John.
Now, just to set the scene, can you describe what the situation is like in Belfast in the early years of the 1920s?
So, cataclysmic violence is how I describe Belfast from July 1920 until June 1922. And the reasons for the outbreak of violence are a number of factors. First of all, I think it's the mobilization of Protestant ex-servicemen, many of whom, thousands of whom are unemployed, into the Ulster Ex-Servicemen's Association, and also into a new loyalist trade union as well. And so there's a profound anger that men who were employed in 1913 and 1914 come back from the front, come back from the 36th Ulster Division and don't have a job. And so increasingly, one of the ways that more radical loyalists, more sectarian loyalist leaders begin to stir up political dissent is by arguing that now that Northern Ireland is becoming its own entity, that there should be privileges for loyal ex-servicemen. So this is represented through unionist labour, if you wish, the Ulster Unionist Labour Association. And that is building a momentum throughout 1920. And really it takes then the sort of the spark of the Orange demonstration at Finnegy, the sort of mass demonstration that's addressed by Carson. Carson says that if necessary, Ulster loyalists should look to their own means in terms of defending Northern Ireland and not necessarily rely upon the Royal Irish Constabulary or indeed the British state, the British Army to protect their interests. By this time, of course, Carson and others are also beginning to, you know, consider and indeed begin the remobilization of the Ulster Volunteer Force as well, which is happening in the summer of 1920. Then, of course, there are events that happen elsewhere in Ireland. The RIC divisional commander is from Munster, is shot dead. This profoundly angers loyalist Belfast and leads to an outbreak of violence as well. So we then see this, in some ways, a template of violence playing out again, because we've seen this in 1886 and we've seen it in subsequent years whereby there's been rioting. There are riots down, particularly at the docks. So the rioting starts in the Wee Yard, as it was called, Workman and Clark, and then expands into the Harland the Wolf yard as well. And what happens is we see sort of the RAC call it a regular chase-up of Catholic and indeed a group of individuals who are described as rotten prods, i.e. certain as being too close to, you know, being not loyal enough, being too close to perhaps socialist trade union movements. And so these people are chased out, they're locked out of the yard, some are chased into the sea, they're forced to swim for their lives. And that really sort of begins then a sort of a cycle of violence, which ebbs and flows to some extent. I mean, the British Army garrison in Belfast, the Norfolk Regiment, do rather brutally in July and August 1920 get on top of violence. They shoot a number of civilians. some who they allege are involved in rioting. And it does subside to some extent by the late autumn of 1920. However, the decision to create an Ulster Special Constabulary, which is in many ways a co-option of a paramilitary organization, a deliberate attempt by the British state to co-opt what is the Ulster Volunteer Force and also the militant trade union elements, the Ulster Ex-Servicemen's Association, etc., into the Special Constabulary, that then creates a undisciplined armed body that will be involved in many of the atrocities that we see in 1921 and 1922. And then there are, of course, most of the violence is very much concentrated in early 1922. And this is the Loyalist response to the Anglo-Irish Treaty. The Anglo-Irish Treaty is a body blow to Loyalism in the North. This spreads, you know, fear, terror, hysteria, because now they look to down south and they see a state, you know, very different to the Southern Ireland that was expected under the Government of Ireland Act, that will have an army, that will have an air force, that they believe will ultimately try and strangle Northern Ireland at birth. And so this leads to an intense Loyalist backlash. And again, events play into this as well. So we see what is sometimes referred to as the Clonus of Frey, an exchange of fire between the Ulster Special Constabulary and the new National Army in Clonus, which leads to deaths on both sides. That leads to sort of an explosion of violence in Belfast in February 1922, and then a real spike from that period from February to April. So overall, we have, you know, just under sort of 500 people dead, clearly many more who are seriously hurt. And we have thousands of people expelled from their homes and their jobs during this period, including, of course, most of whom are Catholic, but a substantial number as well, of course, are Protestants.
Now, Ed, as you know, in nationalist terminology, the period's known as the pogrom.
Yeah.
Which implies kind of very one-sided, communal, some people say ethnic violence, sectarian violence. And obviously people will argue endlessly about this, but from your research, it does seem that it is very largely one-sided violence in Belfast. And a lot of the Protestants killed in Belfast, there's quite a few, but quite a few of them are actually shot by the police and the army rather than the Catholics. So is it fair actually to call it like one-sided communal violence?
It's sometimes referred to as kind of tripartite conflict, right? Because you have obviously the British army is in the middle, who are suppressing both Republicans and indeed Loyalism. But most of the violence, as you say, John, does come from Loyalists. The majority of the killing is coming from Loyalists, many of whom are members of the police. And, you know, the most dangerous paramilitary organization, which is established really in sort of late 1921 in response to the British Army taking the Beast Specials off the streets because they're so violent, because they're involved in so many atrocities. The Ulster Imperial Guard, you know, they're then co-opted back into the police because ultimately Prime Minister James Craig and indeed the British Army are warned that this group of working class ex-sergeants, ex-corporals from the First World War, 10,000 strong, could be involved in a putsch against the Northern Irish government. So Craig then sort of says, look, I need to, uses the Orange Order as a mediator, and agrees to, you know, after they threatened to depose him, then co-opts them into a new class, the Special Constabulary, the C1 Special. So yes, the police are at the heart of this violence, and sometimes it's very hard to disaggregate the police from paramilitarism at various points, because especially with the Imperial Guards being co-opted into large numbers of Imperial Guards being recruited into the C1 class in the early 22. So you have the army sort of who are at various points forced to, you know, make arrests, forced to shoot at, or indeed shot at by members of the Special Constabulary, particularly the B class and the C1 class. So it's extremely complicated from that point of view in terms of identifying, you know, who are clearly state representatives and then who are policemen come paramilitaries, or who are at one time acting as paramilitaries, but and are not actually deployed as policemen. So it is extremely complicated in that sense. So on the national side, of course, you also have a very strong Hibernian presence in Belfast as well. We know that Joe Devlin, obviously the MP for West Belfast, has been incredibly resilient, incredibly charismatic figure. But the Hibernianism is extremely strong too, in the same way as the Orange Order and the Masonic Lodges sort of, you know, offer opportunities for employment, for, you know, advancement for the unionist loyalist population, including, you know, particularly when it comes to getting skilled labor. Whatever power, and it's limited, that nationalists have in Belfast is often channeled through the Hibernians, not least through their, in terms of getting a loan through a bank or insurance or getting jobs. You know, that's the Hibernian movement is very critical. And Devlin and others are very astute in terms of using this, as well as other Ulster nationalists, Irish nationalists, such as J.D. Nugent. So there's a lot of weapons put into Belfast by Nugent, who's the secretary of the AOH for Ireland. They absolutely, you know, they use ex-servicemen in Belfast and Derry, primarily for defensive purposes, But then when the truce comes, they hand over these weapons to the British Army, which in hindsight, I think, you know, I think the Hibernians themselves kind of hinted that this was a naive and foolish thing to do. And also the IRA seized some of their weapons as well. So because it's such a strongly Devlinite city in many ways and a Hibernian city in many ways, that means that, of course, the republicanism is a minority within a minority. And so what we see then is that the contest increasingly by early 1922, when it comes to atrocities and preventing atrocities, comes, we're looking at much of the violence being about loyalists versus British soldiers. So British soldiers, quite a large number of them are wounded. They only suffer actually one fatality, but there's a number of, you know, seriously wounded, particularly in early 1922. Once violence between the army and loyalists breaks out, it's generally quite short-lived, it's sporadic. Loyalists tend to back down. Initially, they kind of, Imperial Guards think that the army will just get out of their way and they'll be allowed to burn or sort of murder as they wish in North and West Belfast. But when the army doesn't get out of their way, you know, they generally tend to, and indeed some elements of the RIC also oppose them. The exchanges of fire tend to be quite, you know, short-lived between the army and the police. But I've counted, you know, in terms of casualties, I counted quite a lot of Imperial Guards, who some of whom were also C-1 specials, who were shot dead by British soldiers, particularly in early 1922.
And just a quick comment on this. So, like, you know, we're obviously more influenced or affected by the later conflict in Northern Ireland, which certainly in its early years was like the British Army was fighting the IRA, was the main forefront. But in the 1920s, it's something quite different, you know, and it might explain perhaps why British troops were welcomed by Catholics in 1969. The fact that in the earlier troubles in the 20s, not quite neutral, the role of the British Army in Belfast, but somewhere in that spectrum.
Yeah, I think so. Obviously, in the 1920s, you know, I'm originally, as you know, John, from West Cork. So I have to keep in my mind, I grew up with sort of accounts, many of them obviously proved to be accurate, of the Essex Regiment. And the Essex Regiment are also present in, actually based in Carrickfergus at one point in 1922. And so getting my head around the idea that, you know, soldiers from the British Army, which have been involved in atrocities clearly during the War of Independence period, would sort of act to try to prevent large-scale atrocities in Belfast by loyalists. That's a complicated thing to kind of, you know, it's something which we need to interrogate carefully. And I think in Munster, for example, the British Army had, you know, it was martial law. They had drumhead court martials. They had, you know, they had the state was incredibly punitive. And once you give the army that rope, they tend to take all of it and more, right? So Munster was in some ways, you know, our parts of the rest of Ireland were a recipe for the British Army doing incredibly brutal, atrocious things, which we know soldiers were involved in. In the North is always different because, you know, there's various points. You know, one point, James Craig urges the army to introduce martial law in Belfast. And they said, fine, because the first commander, a guy called Commandant Colonel Carter Campbell, says, well, fine, delighted, because the first people we're going to arrest are primarily Orange bigots and sectarian murderers. And they're very much top of our list. And then we'll also get some Republicans, too. And that's when Craig, you know, he absolutely turns pale and says, OK, no martial law, absolutely no martial law, because the army's 15 Brigade, who are in Belfast, their argument is that most of the violence comes from loyalists. So if you want to use martial law, it has to be directed against people who are perpetrating most of the violence. Quite simple. Whereas Craig had assumed that they would sort of go after Republicans because these are disloyal people. That's where the army are a complicated beast and a complicated institution. They see their job suppressing large-scale atrocity in Belfast, and they will go after the main perpetrators of that. And particularly, I think it's helpful in some ways that the Norfolk Regiment are from Norwich, right? From, you know, that's their home city. Norfolk, you know, they have very little interest in conflicts in Ireland in terms of the politics of Ireland. Many of them have married local girls in the city, a high proportion of which are Catholic. They have some understanding for the city in terms of sympathy, human sympathy for some of the burnings that they witnessed, some of the murderous behavior. I mean, Belfast is very distinct in terms of the overwhelming victims during the early 1920s are clearly civilians in the city, whereas if you look elsewhere, you know, it's much lower in terms of civilians being attacked and the type of violence that they witness, you know, attempts to burn women alive in the street, or, you know, kind of, this is for young soldiers who, many of whom haven't been exposed to the First World War, you know, they're genuinely in their diaries and in their reports are genuinely horrified, you know, by this type of violence, and they have no liking for the groups that are involved in it. So I think it's a complicated story, but it's a very interesting one. And it shows that in this case, the British Army in the 1920s was willing to act very strongly sometimes against loyalist terror. Now, at some points, because obviously they were acting under legislation that allowed, as elsewhere in Ireland at this time, that allowed the police to assume primacy over security. But a devastating mistake by Prime Minister Lloyd George was that in late November 1921, he meets with James Craig in London, and Craig points to the Imperial Guards, right? So the Imperial Guards are basically, many of them have been serving already as B specials, right? So they're ex-servicemen, they've been in the B specials. They weren't too happy with being the B specials because it was kind of part-time, they wanted more employment, and they were angry with a lack of housing, lack of opportunities, etc. And now the Imperial Guards, who have been, you know, formed up in battalions, who are led by the kind of NCO, the non-commissioned officer class of the 36th Ulster Division, who have, many of whom have no liking for their former officers, right? So the kind of lairdish or business elite that had commanded the UVF in 1914. And they've actually refused really to serve in the UVF. They prefer the Imperial Guards because it's a labor-linked, it's a loyalist labor-linked organization. And they turn around to Craig, as I said before, and they say, you know, we have demands, and if you don't meet them, we will turn our 3 yards of steel in your direction. And Craig then, you know, is understandably alarmed from his position and goes to London and says, your decision, decision by the British Army, by Dublin Castle, who are, Dublin Castle is despised by loyalists during this period, rump Dublin Castle, you know, during the truce period. They have ordered the B specials off the streets now for good reason. The military reported that the B specials, particularly in August, late August 1921, early September, were involved in lots of atrocities, burnings, murders. And you take them off the streets, and the result is now I have a insurrectionist loyalist movement that is well armed and could overthrow me. Now, is that something you want? And Lloyd George essentially blinks and says, let the Northern Irish, new Northern Irish government that has been establishing itself since sort of mid-1921, well, a little bit earlier, let's now allow them to take over policing primacy in Northern Ireland, right? So there's an immediate reaction from Dublin Castle, which says, absolutely not. The army should remain in control and maintain primacy in Northern Ireland over the security situation. It would be disastrous. The RIC are not capable. Essentially, they're a decomposing force, is the kind of argument. And the specials are just dangerous. So you cannot let Richard Dawson Bates, the Minister for Home Affairs, take over security primacy. So there's a kind of period of confusion, actually, where the army and General Archibald Cameron, who's the commander in the north for Ulster District for the army, you know, he really pushes back and says, you know, I cannot have a situation where the police are ordering my troops what to do, because the police here are, he talks about, you know, the police are complicit in what he calls the Orange Pogrom. He talks about the Orange Pogrom. And, you know, he also talks about Sinn Féin Pogrom, by the way. he's basically telling, so there's kind of a real shove back for the military in the civilians' direction. And Leamington Worthington Evans, who's the Secretary of State for War, kind of backs the army and says, you can't have this. So there's kind of a fudge in early 1922 where the army are still saying, we're in control. Craig and Dawson Bates are saying, no, it should be us. But Dawson Bates kind of accept that if the military say no, and London doesn't kind of force the agreement of November 1921, that there's not a lot they can do. That changes with the Special Powers Act of April 1922. And in what's interesting, in March and April, you know, the army are, particularly after the, you know, these large-scale massacres, the McMahon atrocity, six members of the same household being sort of lined up and killed in Kinnear Terrace in North Belfast, and then the Arnon Street massacre, again, sort of, you know, six Catholics killed, four of whom are ex-servicemen who are sort of, you know, killed in horrific ways in their houses. You know, the army are saying you have to completely reform the specials, essentially disband them, reform them. You need a commission of inquiry into these murders that is divorced from the Irish police. And if we don't do this, we'll lose the population and we'll lose them forever. So the army in some ways are kind of playing this like strangely Cassandra view where they can see what the atrocities are going to, what they're going to lead to, but they get ignored. And they get ignored primarily because the British government doesn't want to send soldiers that they need elsewhere. They're expensive and, you know, they need them in Europe and they need them in Mesopotamia, Iraq, etc. So they just don't want to, they think there'll be a loyalist backlash and they can't cope with it. So to some extent, it's different from the later troubles in that the army are really strongly advocating a very hard approach to loyalism, where they're more circumspect in the later troubles, even in the early troubles. But of course, the British government's calculation in both conflicts is the same. Loyalist backlash means it's expensive in terms of troops, in terms of we don't want a two-front war. So when it comes to it, once loyalist terror puts it up to us, we'll back down.
Looking back at this period, this seems to be the biggest problem, and it seems almost inconceivable and bizarre, the abdication of responsibility by the British government, that in such a partisan situation with such a partisan government in Belfast, that they're willing to turn over all the security responsibility and abdicate responsibility from the situation entirely.
Yeah, it's remarkable. I mean, you know, at one point as well, the British Army, General Cameron, who's again the Ulster District Commander for the North, he sort of says, whatever you do, don't hand over the UVF weapons to the Special Constabulary. You know, they've got estimates of up to 8,000 rifles, some of them which actually don't work very well or haven't been oiled properly, but they have large amounts of weapons. And they actually hand those weapons, eventually the order comes through that, you know, from London via Dublin Castle, that, you know, this has been agreed and Craig needs his weapons and we don't want to actually give the Special Constabulary other weapons, you know, so just hand over whatever you have. And the army, I think, so, you know, reluctantly do that. And once, so they hand over weapons at a time in February 1922, which are then supposed to be given to elements such as the C1 class, again, recruited significantly from the Imperial Guards. And this is just disastrous policy. This is just pouring, you know, petrol onto an extremely, you know, just a horrific cauldron of atrocity. That's what they do. So, no, yeah, I agree. I mean, I think there's quite a lot of blame to go around here. I think Winston Churchill particularly is very weak Secretary of State during this period. It seems very reluctant to confront Craig in the way. The British government have this dawning realization as well that they're arming up to ultimately 31,000 special constables. You know, in March 1922, there's only 5,000 soldiers in what is Northern Ireland, right? So, you know, they're looking at this going, wow. And then there's a, James Craig makes it plain as well in the spring of 1922 to Lloyd George's government that, you know, if you try and force things upon me, like if the results of the planned for boundary commission don't go to my liking, I reserve the right to use my forces to refuse to implement the decisions of things like the boundary commission. And at that point, you'd be like Tom Jones, key advisor to Lloyd George, like, hang on, this is the British government that will be telling you to implement the Boundary Commission. And Craig is unmoved. You know, I will use my forces. So suddenly it dawns upon them, our inattention to essentially what is threatened loyalist insurrection. And they've been repeating this for quite a long time. This shouldn't be new to them. It sits very awkwardly with the fact that the War Office is now paying for 31,000, you know, for a force that is, I mean, at one point they're asking for more than 40,000. 2% of the War Office budget, for the whole imperial defense budget, that we are paying for these forces that we are being told will be used against us. I mean, this is, to say it's a dereliction, you know, or a mistake would be to underplay how seismically damaging this is to Irish affairs. And it's because their attention has been so focused on Dublin and so focused on dealing with, you know, the anti-treatyites and the negotiations of 1921 that they've missed, and they always miss, is the fact that there's a loyalist veto here that is going to, you know, you're going to be confronted with. And at some point, you need to decide whether you're facing it down or not. And instead, obviously, they duck.
We should talk briefly about the other side of the equation, like the Republicans and Nationalists in Belfast. And I mean, you know, traditionally, the argument goes either the IRA is provoking the loyalists and they're causing the violence in Belfast, or they're ineffectively defending the Catholics. Basically, there was one of those two arguments. I mean, you know, you've got the likes of, as you know all about this, Ed, obviously, but Roger McCorley, who was one of the leading Republicans in Belfast, and he kind of tends to equate the two things. Like, so he says, you know, there's the state, the British state is killing the Catholics and giving the arms to the Orange Murder Gang. And at the same time, he's saying we're fighting the War of Independence in Belfast. But I guess a Republican's just impotent in Belfast, basically.
So I think, you know, for me, the Belfast Guard is an important innovation in early 1922, in that, you know, the Collins does.
Hang on, tell the listeners, what's the Belfast Guard, though?
Oh, yeah. So this is really by, I mean, but I think, look, there's two things going on here. On the one hand, Collins's strategy, and indeed Ona Duffy, you know, who's the great, look, we need to remember, is, you know, the great Northern commander of the IRA at this period. And indeed, he's a truce liaison officer who's sent, you know, after the truce to Belfast. You know, O'Duffy has clear instructions from Collins, which is accelerate the burnings of Protestant businesses, unit-owned businesses, accelerate the attacks. We are at war in Belfast. And that's very much a message, you know, of O'Duffy and indeed Collins at various points in late 1921, early 1922. And there are others. I mean, Louis J. Walsh is one of them, right? Very senior kind of Republican leader. Later was on a Sinn Féin organizer in the North. And he says, you know, you know what the loyalist response will be an escalation. They will try and outbid you in terms of violence, and the primary victims will be civilians, right? So there are some people in the Sinn Féin in the North who are saying, You know, now is not the, this is not, unless you're going to dedicate a significant amount of the national, i.e. the 32 county IRA resources to the north, you should not be escalating a conflict in which loyalists, particularly in Belfast, will hold civilians hostage. That's Walsh's viewpoint on it. And he's called a white flagger and sort of, you know, seen as, and people like very capable IRA leaders like Roger McCorley and Seamus Woods. I mean, I've, you know, in terms of organization, in terms of courage, right, these guys are remarkable. I mean, they're operating in a very, very difficult city. They're some of the most dynamic IRA leaders, I think, of their time. But they are wedded to this O'Duffy and Collins kind of view that we can, that the burnings will work, that ultimately unionism, this is all top down. Craig, etc., Dawson Bates, they only think about their pockets. Belfast is the biggest city in Ireland. Their customers, many of their customers in the south, they'll ultimately back down if you show them the economic costs of resisting some type of national, you know, rapprochement or national, some type of north-south, you know, agreement or compromise whereby the island isn't harshly partitioned. And so they believe in this. And so at the same time as Catholic civilians are coming under enormous attack, Collins does realize, well, hang on, we're not really, you know, it's becoming obvious, and it's very obvious to the people of West Belfast, particularly, and North Belfast, that their primary means of defense is the British Army. And that's why the British Army, Republicans don't attack the British Army, right? They never attack the British Army. There's just, you know, in fact, actually, some IRA volunteers talk about fighting alongside the British Army in terms of the defense of working class areas. Now, this is not corroborated on the British Army side, and I haven't found that in reports, but that's what Republicans are saying. So there's a deliberate sort of non-aggression de facto pact, you know, in Belfast between the British Army and the IRA. And so I think Collins finds this, you know, this is brought to his attention, and he tries to then strengthen defensive measures by setting up something called the Belfast Guard, which is 50 to 100 strong. They kind of give them, you know, good weapons, good rifles, lots of ammunition. It's not enough. It's not enough. The sheer scale of loyalist violence, you know, we're talking about, you know, gangs of loyalists in North Belfast that are hundreds strong, you know, just in the York Road alone. You know, it's estimated by the British Army that the Imperial Guards can mobilize up to between 700 to 800 people at any one time, many of whom are veterans of the First World War, and pretty much all of whom have access to weapons, is the British Army's assessment. So it's not enough. And meanwhile, so Collins has this kind of, he is getting reports from his brother-in-law, who's not really familiar, Patrick O'Driscoll, who's former editor of the West Cork People, who's not really familiar maybe with Belfast, and he's giving him a kind of optimistic viewpoint. I think he really admires the kind of can-do attitude of this young generation of IRA leaders who are incredibly dedicated to the cause, very active. But ultimately, of course, it is Seamus Woods himself who goes down to Dublin in the early summer of 1922 and really sort of pleads with Collins to call it all off, because they can't. He says, you know, the atrocities are going to get worse and worse because we're stimulating something that we can't overcome. And they know by this stage as well, even by March 1922, April 1922, you know, the National Army and O'Duffy are becoming consumed with the threat from anti-treatyites. They're not focused on the north. And so asking them to continue to escalate is just, you know, it's just leading to that's the primary victims are going to be thousands of Catholic civilians.
Now, Ed, why do you think the McMahon murders are so emblematic of the violence during this period?
I'd say, Colin, that they're not, for me, they're not necessarily emblematic or representative, because I always think, you know, what's more representative is, you know, horrific loyalist murderer like Alec Buck Robinson, sort of, you know, killing a cleaner in a cinema or something. That's more, it's just picking on the weak. You know what I mean? That's the typical kind of modus operandi of someone like Alec Robinson. It's just to shoot the most, you know, it's to torture his neighbor. If his a woman, Jane Rafferty, was a neighbor of his, he just, you know, went in with his gang and just tortured her and then killed her. You know, that's far more sort of representative of the violence. I think why the McMahon murders are so remembered is that this was for many people, suburban kind of Dublin and Belfast, and, you know, had been the idea that the elite of nationalism. So Old McMahon's a very connected guy. He was connected to the police. He was very connected to the Hibernians, Joe Devlin.
And so, I'm sorry to jump in, Ed, but just like for listeners who are not familiar, what happens in the McMahon murders is basically a whole family's kind of wiped out, or all the male members wiped out, and then they're prosperous Catholics, like well-off Catholics.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the thing. So essentially what happens is very, Kinnear Terrace is still there. At that time, it was kind of a, you know, very much luxury houses for the kind of managerial classes of Belfast. You know, it's really sort of, the McMahons had made it. They came from, you know, reasonably modest background in rural County Down. They had moved to Belfast in around the 1880s, 1890s, Owen McMahon and his brothers. And they had bought, you know, some remarkably, well, they'd set up a kind of publican business, and they'd also been involved in livestock trading. And they'd made a lot of money and done very, very well. And therefore, they were kind of, they were now, had arrived in sort of the middle class Belfast society, and they were very connected and well known. And so the idea that a group of loyalist murderers, you know, four of whom were in police uniforms, one not, could kind of crash their way into this suburban sort of middle class utopia of kind of Belfast, crash their way in and line up all the male members of the family, plus a barman called Eddie McKinney, and shoot, you know, Owen, four of his sons, and Eddie McKinney dead. Just horrified, kind of, it sparked something in the imagination, I think, of the political elite and also the media class, and it sort of spread across to Britain as well. It was just seeing the whole annihilation of a family in such a kind of callous and methodical kind of way in middle-class Belfast, what was unusual, and therefore it sparked kind of fears that nobody's safe now, that they're going to wipe out nationalist Belfast if they're targeting the elite as well.
I mean, something that comes out of your research, Ed, and also people like Nadia Dobranska, who's working on this, for example, is, you know, I hadn't really appreciated how different the violence in the north was from the violence in the rest of Ireland. Like, if you look at the numbers, for example, in Dublin, which is where I've studied, obviously, about 500 people are killed in Dublin as well in the equivalent years, you know, 20 to 23. But it's entirely different. You know, you're not having people killed at random, tortured, their houses burned down. You're not having whole streets displaced. Like, in many ways, it is worse what goes on in Belfast.
Yeah, it is. And I think that's, I mean, it's, in some ways, it's look, the North has this history of paramilitarism, you know, that goes back a long way, right? So in terms of, you know, we can talk about 1886 and sort of how the loyalist mobs kind of chased the RIC out of the Shankill Road, and who actually, then the RIC withdrew from the Shankill Road and was seen as kind of a great victory for loyalism. So you can talk about sort of, there are templates of violence there that go back in terms of intercommunal violence, violence that is representative in terms of targeting civilians from the other side. It goes back a long way. But of course, you know, loyalists feel that they're in this existential battle. They genuinely feel that, you know, there's many people who have this sort of very, the sense of fear that there's going to be a major invasion of the North. And that is planned. I mean, you know, there is, at one point, people are talking this up as well. And there are people sort of loudly advocating this. And Owen Duffy is making it known in Belfast there's going to be a major invasion of the North at some point by the new army, right? So of course, loyalists feel that they're in this existential battle, and they fully believe that that will be accompanied by mass atrocities against Protestants in the north, or, you know, who were presumed to be loyalists. So that sparks something. And then I do think the First World War is important, right? So, you know, a lot of the killing is done in the north, in Belfast, by ex-soldiers, particularly on the loyalist side. Now, Alec Robinson's only served in the Merchant Navy, so he didn't really see active service. But, you know, some of the most kind of vicious individuals, you know, some of whom I name in my book, David Duncan, Geordie Harper, like these are guys who are very, very familiar with killing and do it with an incredible methodical callousness, right? So, yeah, I think First War matters in terms of, if we can look at a kind of a dangerous veterans organizations that is coming back with little respect for authority and fully willing to use extreme violence, you know, as we see in other European countries during this time, then the Austro Imperial Guards are kind of, you know, the number one body I would point to. But of course, you know, on the Hibernian side, and certainly on the IRA side, you know, there's a reason why John Armand Carr Morgan in Carrickhill is called Armand Carr. Of course, he served in the British Army, you know, so these guys are feared. And, you know, the IRA do rely upon, on the loyalist side, they fear these ex-soldiers on the Republican side. And some of them are very good shots. And the army, British Army, you know, write a lot of intelligence reports around, and they're particularly interested in, you know, identifying IRA gunmen who have military backgrounds, because these tend to be the more effective when it comes to sniping and things like that.
Anybody who's read about the McMahon murders or listened to interviews about them has always heard one name popping up as a possible suspect or a possible organizer of the murders, and that's Inspector Nixon. Now, in your book, you don't really believe that he's the primary organizer of this murder. What was your take on it?
So Nixon is an enormously complicated figure. And obviously we've had, you know, I think Nixon deserved his reputation in Belfast in the 1920s as being somebody who was complicit in murder, in loyalist murder. And he certainly went out of his way when it came to when eventually the Northern Irish government decide to, after the violence subsides, the Republican campaign is called off, when they eventually begin to intern the most dangerous, vicious, you know, and only basically approximately, well, there's 18 of them identified out of, you know, hundreds are interned in total, despite loyalists being responsible for most of the violence in Belfast. But when they eventually get to intern, Nixon is always, you know, the first to stand up and say, despite police evidence, overwhelming police evidence, the contrary, say, no, he's a wonderful citizen. You know, he did nothing wrong. He's a good friend of mine. So he deserves, he's certainly seen by the Northern Irish government and by the British Army as being very complicit in murder. And indeed, that some of the men under his command are involved in murder and that he's also involved in this.
Sorry, just a detail to get in there. He's actually from County Cavan, which of course ends up on the southern side of the border.
He is, and he's quite, look, so Nixon has a reputation before. He's obviously active in, he's appointed to a district inspector. He's had, you know, he's risen from the ranks, right? So he's seen as being a tough, competent sergeant. He's initially sent as to suppress the 1916 rising in Galway. It does reasonably well there. He's then rewarded by being elevated to district inspector, gets sent to Strokestown, which is a very disturbed district, as they call it, does well there. And so he's a troubleshooter. He's then sent to Listenskee. That's where he meets O'Duffy for the first time. They have a personal animosity that is very important for the story, right? Because O'Duffy is, of course, also in command of parts of Southeast Fermanagh. O'Duffy's men successfully managed to infiltrate Tempo Barracks. And a sergeant who's kind of connected to a loyalist family in Armagh, Sergeant Lucas, is murdered in a pretty nasty, pretty, you know, horrific way during the storming of the barracks. Nixon takes that very, very personally and addresses O'Duffy directly in the inquest, you know, saying that he cares no more about the IRA than a dog, kind of, you know, that kind of stuff, that kind of language. And O'Duffy and him have this personal animosity that is important then for when they arrive in Belfast. Nixon arrives in late 1920. O'Duffy arrives kind of the late summer, late July 1921, just after the truce. They immediately try and kill each other. O'Duffy's determined to hunt down Nixon. Nixon's determined to kill O'Duffy. They have this personal animosity. Meanwhile, Nixon's wife is terminally ill, which is important, right? He's going through an extreme time. His brother, he's worked as a detective in Dublin Castle for the Dublin Metropolitan Police. You know, the IRA are busy trying to kill him and he's busy trying to leave the country. Meanwhile, a lot of Nixon's friends and family from near Ballyjames Duff in a place called Gradham are being targeted by the IRA there. There's a fair bit of intimidation going on. There's some burnings, there's some, you know. So he's under enormous amount of stress. None of that apologizes for. And of course, he feels that Craig has betrayed his people, right? So they've left, you know, he campaigns for the rest of his life. A lot of people, you know, from the three counties who migrate to Dublin during this period end up in Sandy Row and the Shankill, right? So and that's why they have their various lodges, the Monaghan, True Blues, etc. So he campaigns, West Belfast is very sympathetic, Loyalist Belfast is very sympathetic to the Lost Counties, as they call them. And Nixon is very much the leader of them. So he has him and his men. There's also a guy called Henry Gordon, who's a detective constable, who's the British Army believes is involved in the Arnold Street killings. Gordon is also from County Cavan, right? And a First World War veteran. Gordon, you know, these men feel very betrayed and they feel as if Craig, you know, has so they see themselves as a militant check and further betrayal. So Nixon is undoubtedly involved in that hard, militant, murderous side of loyalism. I don't think that's in question, and not least the sources in the British Army sources and Northern Irish government sources seem to back that up. But when it comes to actually being present at murders, that's where, you know, some of the evidence that has been sort of presented. So, you know, there was the Nixon memo, which was drafted in 1924 by Irish military intelligence, which actually contradicts a lot of the Sinn Féin investigations in 1921 and 1922 in terms of, you know, it's determined in 1924 to place Nixon at the scene of various murders, whereas the various sort of much more detailed factual Sinn Féin investigations of the period, you know, never claimed that. So it seems to me to be quite a political document, and there are some factual inaccuracies in it in terms of, you know, times, locations, individuals, you know, that can be disproved, right? So there's lots of, and indeed medical evidence, it's just not backed up in terms of allegations of, you know, certain tortures and things. So it is quite a lurid document, but I think we should be very careful about claiming that it is an entirely accurate one. And so Nixon, what Seamus Wood said about Nixon is that Nixon would never be present at a murder because he didn't want to implicate himself. And that's also very much the assessment of, you know, the more professional police officers as well, who later write damning reports about Nixon, that he's very careful not to get his hands dirty. You know, he'll sort of turn a blind eye, maybe even direct, right? But so I think by excessively focusing on Nixon, it, as a consequence of claims made in the Irish, in the Irish Bulletin and also in the Nixon memo, we miss a more complicated story, which is that Nixon was one of the people in authority who permitted and was permissive towards atrocity. But there were, in terms of the actual acts of killing, we need to look at other much more lethal individuals who were very happy to pull the trigger. Among them, you know, I named Geordie Harper, David Duncan. You know, these are people who are, and of course, David Duncan, in my view, had a motivation to kill the MacMahons. You know, so
we'll get on to David Duncan just a sec, if that's okay. But just on Nixon, so you know, you make a number of points in the book about just the criminal evidence, if you like. So the people involved in the shooting of the McMahon family, the murder of the McMahon family, have strong Belfast accents. They're relatively young men, and whereas Nixon by this point is a middle-aged man, he's quite overweight, and he has a Cavan accent. Yes.
Oh,
you know, kind of.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, but is it possible?
Cavan accent.
Yeah. So, I mean, the Cavan accent, unfortunately, subject to much mockery over the years.
Even including in Belfast. Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But, I mean, is it possible, nevertheless, that Nixon is involved in ordering it if he's involved in this thing and not necessarily there himself?
It's possible. I just haven't found the evidence to support that. And I looked for connections. So, you know, the individual, Dave Duncan, who has a strong motive, you know, obviously he does move in the same circles, but Duncan is far more influenced by others. He's from North Belfast and he's far more influenced and close to people like Tom McConnell, who's a militant unionist MP for North Belfast. He's far more tied into the kind of York Road, York Street kind of loyalism. He's tied into sort of the Docker trade unionism of North Belfast as well, or loyalism. And so I just, when I was trying to trace a direct connection and to see, you know, Nixon is much closer to the Shankill. He's really close to Shankill loyalism and he's really close to, you know, the B special commanders there, Harry Taylor, and some of the killers in the Shankill area, you know, so he defends them. He tries to not have them turn.
To keep interrupting you, but it's a feature of Belfast conflict. It's a feature of Belfast conflict that it's hyper-local, like North Belfast is entirely different frame of reference from West Belfast and South Belfast and so on. So.
Yeah, and Nixon is interested. So he dams certain areas, right? So he has this idea of collective guilt. So for him, Arnon Street, for example, is an entirely Republican area. And he doesn't see it as, you know, essentially because of the Carrick Hill IRA, who are literally on his doorstep, he's obsessed with them. And he doesn't, like Henry Gordon, who serves under him in RIC, you know, they don't believe that there is such a thing as innocence in Arnon Street, right? Which is a horrific thing for a police force to ever conclude. But that's what they think. Kinnaird Terrace, middle class kind of, you know, Antrim Road suburbia, the McMahons. Nixon is, I trying to find a motive for that is, you know, to sort of balance up against the motive of David Duncan, who I identify as a prime suspect. You know, there just isn't one. Whereas in Arnon Street, there is no doubt in my mind that Brown Square Barracks, Nixon's C district, because again, North Belfast is D district. C district police are very involved in Arnon Street, including, you know, Henry Gordon. So there's strong evidence for that. But I cannot find evidence for Nixon to be involved in Kinnaird Terrace. It doesn't mean that, you know, he would not be a man to investigate it. Certainly, it's not his district, so he doesn't have to. It's actually DI William Lynn who's investigating it. But, you know, but I think we need to be open to the idea that there are many very dangerous gangs at work, loyalist gangs at work in Belfast, West Belfast, North Belfast. Nixon is certainly linked to gangs in West Belfast, but his ties to the north of the city seem to be less.
I mean, one of the things to come out of your research, Ed, very strong thing is like the kind of autonomy of a lot of the loyalist paramilitaries, that they're not necessarily being directed at all by a great conspiracy with Craig and Carson at the top and so on. But just one to wrap up on Nixon, I mean, he takes two libel cases later on in the post-conflict period when he's actually an MP in Stormont against people who alleged he was involved in the McMahon murders. It is out there. And I mean, given the nature of British and Irish libel laws, I mean, it is very difficult to win them, you know, if you're it's easy to win them if you're a defendant, to put it that way.
Well, again, and this is where the bulletin is important, right? Because you get people like, you know, Patrick O'Driscoll and others. And also, you know, there's some interesting people like Desmond Crean, right? So who's sort of a former actor, owns a pub in Belfast. He's employed by military intelligence at one point, very briefly in 1924. And I suspect has a hand in the Nixon memo. Is basically sort of taking stuff, which is really, let's be honest, is not a sort of a police criminal investigation. It's designed for propaganda purposes. And so it's a bit more lurid. It sort of is trying to win sympathy in Britain and America and places. And as some of the atrocities are exaggerated, right? So these accusations then filter around and then sort of ultimately lead to the Derry Journal. So, there's a letter to the Derry Journal that draws upon the allegations in the bulletin. I'm actually by a former policeman, but it's not hard in a defamation case to, there isn't actually the evidence. You know, there is no police witness to sort of, at the time there are, Nixon is, persona non grata within the RUC by this stage, right? So there's lots of people who would, who want to damn him and believe that he's involved in murders, not least a murder Republican called John Shevlin, right? The Northern Irish government conclude that he's got something to do with that. But in terms of, let's say, being able to stand over these things and, in terms of evidence to let's say, even if, and I don't think they would have been, even if the RUC were tempted to prosecute, trying to find that evidence, they weren't proactively trying to find evidence, but it's not immediately apparent. And the Irish Bulletin, as I say, the War Bulletin and the Belfast atrocities that they were disseminating, again, some of this is factually inaccurate. So it means that he easily wins his defamation cases, which is a great shame because Nixon doesn't deserve, the idea that he would, he is, as I say, complicit in many of the atrocities during this period. So, but pinning the McMahon murders on him is something that clearly in court he's going to win,
Well, Ed, you've mentioned his name now a couple of times, David Duncan. What did you find out about him from your research?
Actually, Duncan also won a defamation case against, I mentioned the Freeman's Journal earlier, that was Duncan who won that case. And, he took Freeman's Journal in the summer of 1922, published, an allegation that he was involved in a murder. And that was also the very much the assessment of the police, right? But because they printed it and the police didn't come forward to say, yes, this man is notorious, he's a shock, that the Irish government itself ended up having to pay David Duncan, who was a known loyalist killer in North Belfast. They ended up having to pay him compensation because it had been Patrick O'Driscoll and the Irish Publicity Bureau, right, who had been behind disseminating this material to the Freeman's Journal, who just kind of rehashed it. And so the Freeman's Journal, the editors just contacted the government and said, Sean Lester, actually, and said, he went on to be obviously a very senior diplomat, and said, you need to pay us. And they did pay them. So it's very disappointing to think that he got Irish, he got taxpayers' money from the Irish state, but he did. So Duncan is a fascinating figure in that he's quickly identified, including by IRA intelligence in Belfast, as being, one of the primary killers, one of the most dangerous men in Belfast. And he's serving, he has a number of people who protect him. Tom McConnell, MP, I mentioned, another guy called Samuel Waring, who's a senior Orange leader, and his nephew, also called Sam, who's a senior Ulster Special Constabulary commander. These are people who at various points are identified by IRA intelligence and also, to some extent within the RIC itself as being, these are very dangerous individuals. And the RIC eventually do prosecute in North Belfast as a senior Catholic police officer called D.I. William Lynn. He was known as being the most brilliant kind of investigator of his generation of the RIC. He arrests Duncan in early 1922 and charges him with murder and attempted murder. One is the murder of, one charge is related to the attempted, the murder of James MacIver. He's a publican in the York Road area in November 1921. Duncan is also charged for the attempted murder of Patrick McMahon, who is another publican in the same area, so also on the York Road. And here's where I began to look at this in terms of the police file and think, hang on, how many Patrick McMahons are there in North Belfast who are publicans? I could only find one. And I searched endlessly to try and find another Patrick McMahon, particularly who would own a very large business. It's a very impressive business in the York Road, the major thoroughfare. It's a big grocery shop as well. He's just taken it over. Patrick McMahon was a fascinating figure himself in that he was always willing to take risk when most Catholic publicans in the area were getting burned out or shot. Patrick McMahon decided this was a great business opportunity. He's that type of figure, apparently. And so he moved in, but he was connected enough to people like William Lynn to make an official police complaint when this guy, David Duncan, showed up and tried to shoot him. Somehow it was getting dark. Duncan ducked. He avoided being killed. He gave a statement to the police, and that is becoming increasingly unusual at this time because so many witnesses in jury court cases are being shot, being killed, wounded, that it's getting almost very, very difficult for D.I. William Lynn to actually charge loyalists. because they don't, it's not like in Munster where you have these kind of military, you know, court martials, whatever. It's not like that. This is still jury trials. And so intimidation, loyalists always make people like David Duncan and others, Jordy Harper, I mentioned, they always make it their business to target witnesses who give evidence against loyalists. And this is a pattern of killing and shooting of witnesses. McMahon is confident enough or brazen enough and courageous enough to come forward and say, I'll give evidence against David Duncan, who, you know, this guy is a mass murderer. He's, you know, he's involved in constant violence. I'm going to give evidence against him. And then a number of other people come forward, including actually a former soldier, Bernard Monaghan, who served with Duncan in Salonika, right? So he recognized him. He saw him on the day, he said. He saw what he did. He was on the streets. The trial collapses, right? So it doesn't go anywhere. Actually, there's a police officer, D.I. William Linz Jr., a more junior police officer, Sergeant Rob, gives evidence in favor of David Duncan, saying he's a great guy. And you know, and the judge decides, he said the police evidence is contradictory. He says Bernard Monaghan is a closet, you know, Republican. And the whole thing, you know, Duncan walks free. Now, later I became immediately interested in that because he's, you know, the trial takes place in late February. So, you know, not long afterwards, obviously, the McMahons, Patrick McMahon, I believe, is the brother of Owen McMahon. Patrick McMahon immediately sells his businesses. He's given clear warning. He starts selling his businesses. He vacates the York Road. Bernard Monaghan says that he's going to be plugged to, quote unquote, and immediately sort of rushes to Dublin, joins the National Army, actually ends up in the Dublin Guard fighting in a very difficult part of the Civil War, right? So they clear out. Now, who's left? Who's still in the phone book? Well, the only McMahon still, you know, the principal McMahon, he's still in terms of connected to Patrick, who's around, is Owen McMahon, who's lives not far from, is in North Belfast, not far from the York Road. So Duncan, in my view, is by far the primary, you know, the person I believe should be the primary suspect for these killings, because I believe he has a motive to a vengeance against the McMahon family that is very much in keeping with the loyalist behavior previously. However, he's also a man who is psychiatrically very unwell. We later learn because he has a, you know, like many murderous loyalists, after the what has been called the pogrom period, he then is encouraged to leave Belfast. He eventually leaves Belfast. He says he's paid by the Orange Order to go to Canada. He says he gets a first-class ticket. When he arrives in Canada, this is in 1929, it's clearly obvious he's mentally unwell. He's serious mental health issues. He is eventually confined to psychiatric care after he attacks a police officer with an axe. The police officer is trying to enter his house in Toronto, because he's threatened his wife with an axe, and there's, you know, neighbors hear screams and his wife flees the house. And anyway, this is a serious incident. And, you know, Toronto's psychiatrists make clear that this man is a paranoid schizophrenic who has very likely suffered from a mental illness for many years. And he admits to his wife, tells psychiatrists, he admits to murder in Belfast. They regard him as an exceptionally dangerous man, you know, very, very dangerous, and, you know, as somebody who should never be released from intense psychiatric care. And he's not released. He dies at the end on December 31st, 1939, in psychiatric care in Toronto.
I mean, you make clear that in the book that David Duncan, someone who's been through a number of wars, actually, been through the First World War, worse than Civil War, the troubles in Belfast, and it clearly
French Foreign Legion.
You can also. Yeah. French Foreign Legion as well, exactly. That's afterwards, I think, isn't it? He joins the
Nation. That's 1925, 26. Yeah. He doesn't last long. You know, again, he gets dismissed from service in the French Foreign Legion. He seems to have these kind of moments where his mental health kind of collapses and he lurches into really violent periods. And then he has periods where, you know, it seems that he suffers from delusions. He hears voices, but it seems to be kind of come and go with Duncan. So he gets periods where he really, you know, hears voices, he says, telling him to do terrible things, and suffers from, you know, highly delusionary. And alcohol does not help. He's an alcoholic as well. Alcohol tends to bring these things on.
He's clearly a man with very serious mental difficulties, whether it's schizophrenia mixed with PTSD or whatever it is. That's not exclusive to loyalism in the period. I mean, you can talk, there's guys south of the border with the exact same, you know, profile, like Frank Teeling and Charlie Dalton. Sorry to name names, but there you go. What is unusual, what I found in your book about David Duncan, is this micro conflict he's involved in North Belfast there, where the aim seems to be to get rid of Catholic businessmen, you know, to stop the economic advancement of Catholics. It's really micro conflict. It has nothing really to do with questions of the treaty or Irish independence or anything like that.
I agree. Well, this is very much this kind of, so we tend to look, you know, I'm a huge fan of Emmet O'Connor's work on, and, you know, in terms of looking at some of the better sides of trade unionism, right? In terms of the trade unionism that is non-sectarian, the trade unionism that is kind of trying to elevate Belfast away from intercommunal violence, right? But there is a loyalist tendency, which is they regard themselves as anti-establishment, anti-patrician, who's always seen Catholic laborers undercutting the Protestant working man, right? And that is also sort of spills into ideas of owning things like pubs in working class areas, that, like, you know, these should be owned by hardworking Protestants who are associated with unionist labor or with the Masonic or whatever, right? So, like, there's been an ugly tendency to parts of labor as well, right? Within which is there is a kind of a, it seems contradictory in terms of ideals of labor, but there is, you know, an idea of kind of almost a sectarian division within the trade union movement that we need to be aware of. And so there are people who are strongly advocating that, you know, in a what is still sort of a majority Protestant area, let's say, like, particularly, you know, around you know, the docks in North Belfast, they should take back businesses because this is denying employment and ownership for local Protestants, right? So there's a kind of sense that, but of course, that in some ways has been too polite to people like Duncan and some of the people he's involved in. This is simply about gang warfare in terms of territory, turf, embezzlement, extortion. This is not, and so this has echoes of gang warfare in the West Midlands in England or Glasgow in terms of, you know, trying to simply extort money. And in some ways, it's not that dissimilar from loyalism today, right? In terms of people trying to take over pubs, businesses, charge rent. So let's not be too polite to them either. They see this as an enormous opportunity. But also, there is a suspicion among loyalism, I think somewhat real and also exaggerated for expediency, that publicans are involved in republicanism, right? So, and there are, you know, like Sean McEntee's father, you know, King Street in Belfast, like there are Desmond Crean, who I mentioned already, excuse me. You know, these guys are involved in, there are senior republicans, important publicans in Belfast, who are also senior republicans, right? So Sean McEntee is kind of one, but I can, you know, have a kind of list of, so there are some people who are connected to the movement. So you can kind of extend that writ large, which is what people like Duncan do, to James McIver, who he murders, saying, oh, he must have been an IRA commandant. Absolute nonsense. Completely. Either he's deliberately deluding himself, or else he's, you know, his memory is so tinged with poor health and sectarianism that he just doesn't know that McIver is just an ordinary businessman, you know?
Anyone who's read anything about the Belfast pogroms, they're always struck by just appalling instances of violence, individual instances. And one that I came across that I hadn't read about before was a small child being doused in petrol and attempts to set them on fire. And recently on Twitter, you mentioned through all your research, the one that really stuck with you was a pregnant woman. Who they and you might talk about that, but there's so it even seems wrong to identify two individual cases because there's so many of them. What is it about this period that it's not just like the recent troubles, and there was appalling acts of torture and murder during the recent troubles, but it's really on another level during this period?
Yes, I mean, it really is. And I think that's where, you know, I think we need to, I think there should be more attention. There's been wonderful work, you know, by people like Kieran Glennon, Nadia Dobransky, we already talked about. He's, you know, there's people, thankfully, who are doing, you know, really exciting work on this period in Belfast. And I think it's, you know, others, you know, Jim McDermott and others have already sort of, you know, but I think it still deserves more attention, right? Because I think in many ways it sets a template for some of the violence that we see later in the Troubles. That, you know, the people like Alec Robinson, who's sort of elevated as this kind of loyalist hero, you know, is horrific. The violence he perpetrates against women, violence, you know, the way he singles out vulnerable poor people to torture and kill them. You know, this is a person who should not be quote unquote a Belfast folk hero, as he sometimes described. You know, he should be firmly labeled as the murderous, you know, scumbag that he was, right? And I think by not doing that, we sort of, in some ways, this period has been remembered in a strangely kind of tinged way that kind of almost suggests that it's different, very different to the later Troubles. I think if you look at the type of violence that we see in terms of, you know, pregnant women or dousing children with petrol, you know, it's the failure to acknowledge what had broken in Belfast in 1920 to 1922, I think, was, you know, set, traumatized the city, and I think allowed, showed a permissiveness to loyalist paramilitarism that proved to be extremely toxic and ultimately catastrophic in the 1960s and 70s. And, you know, what I find kind of terribly ironic is that, you know, so I talk about a guy called Eric Hayes, who's an British Army intelligence officer in Belfast, who is the one most stridently pushing for the arrests of policemen, loyalist killers who are serving the special constabulary. At one point, he does successfully advocate for D.I. Lynn to be forced into Brown Square Barracks, into C District, to begin the arrests of policemen in Nixon's barracks. And then it collapses, right? And the collapse of that is so damaging in terms of the potential for, there was a moment there where, you know, the Northern Irish police could have been reformed with the right political will. And that moment was lost. And as I say, the consequences were disastrous. But it is ironic that Eric Hayes, you know, his AD siege in the Second World War was a guy called Ian Freeland. He was also was in the Royal Norfolk Regiment. And Ian Freeland, I've been through his papers, has almost zero knowledge of Northern Ireland when he turns up to be GOC in the late 1960s, right? So he's general officer commanding at the start of the Troubles and the start of Operation Banner in 1969. He was one of his patrons, one of his closest confidants was Eric Hayes during the Second World War in the Pacific Theater. Eric Hayes actually takes the Japanese surrender in China. It was disastrous to lose that memory, to lose the memory of the missed opportunities, to lose the memory of the inherent problematic nature of the B specials, which then, of course, you know, we see the B specials back in the streets of North Belfast in 1969 and precipitates, you know, what reawakens all those fears. And by the time the B specials are disbanded, I mean, it's too late, right? It's arguably too late. The kind of a new escalation has been set in train, and it's very difficult to prevent from getting worse. Yeah.
I mean, I want to wrap up with kind of wider lessons about policing divided societies and stuff. But before I do, I mean, we should acknowledge this sectarian killing in Belfast is not entirely one way. So there are also Protestants killed in openly sectarian ways in the period as well.
Yeah. And again, it's often, John, it's often the weakest, I mean, you know, and the most vulnerable. I talk about a gravedigger, you know, a guy called Telford, who's there with his grandson, and he's just simply crossing the city. Again, you know, you get murderers just picking out the most vulnerable people from both communities and killing them in horrific ways. And, you know, to some extent, you know, we need to look, I know that it would come as a, you know, there would be people who obviously direct the word pogrom in one direction, but Protestants also begin to use the word pogrom as well towards what they believe are Sinn Féin indiscriminate killings and burnings directed at working class Protestant areas. So pogrom is a word that's used by a lot of people, and including by people from, Protestant Belfast as well at the time. Now, since then, that's stopped, right? So actually the British Army in their reports talked about a Sinn Féin pogrom, an Orange pogrom, right? And that was General Cameron himself who used the word pogrom at the time. So I think what's been forgotten, as you say, and I'm glad you highlighted it, there's a lot of indiscriminate violence against Protestant civilians as well. And so, you know, we need to remember, if we are going to use the contested and controversial word pogrom for reasons we don't have time to get into today, but, you know, it's obviously contested in terms of its use and whether it's appropriate in an Irish context. If we're going to use it, we should use it, I think, in its broadest sense, you know, because it's not like civilians. This is a campaign that is primarily concentrated against civilians because of their ostensible political beliefs. But let's not dress it up as anything else as being, you know, primarily sectarian. There's a lot of sectarian violence, including against Protestant civilians.
Yeah, I mean, just on the term pogrom, like, this would be a whole other show, you know, but the semantic use of the term pogrom, it's the debate about this seems to get in the way for me of really discussing what went on in Belfast in that time. And I think your book and others like it coming out now are starting to address that. But, like, I mean, for years we were just bogged down and arguing about, is it a pogrom? Does it exactly conform with what we think a pogrom means, you know?
Yeah.
It seems to be a waste of time at this point.
I agree. I think, look, people were, I mean, we have to be fair to people at the time. If you were living in Belfast, this cataclysmic type of violence, you know, this indiscriminate violence. We're living through periods where we're looking at indiscriminate violence, disproportionate violence, you know, towards civilians in other parts of the world, right? We need to be careful that, like, people are looking, they're searching around for words to describe what is, you know, in Belfast, I've talked about precedence, but this is in scale unprecedented. And it is the way it's directed against the weak and the vulnerable, particularly. So people are searching around for a word to describe it. And as I say, so are the British Army. So if we're going to get angry, let's say, at, you know, people in North Belfast using this word at the time to describe what they felt was happening to their communities, I think that's very unfair, not least because the British soldiers who were on the ground also described it as a pogrom. And actually, some of the British Army had seen pogroms, right? So a number of people had seen, like, so if you look at Eric Hayes, for example, he'd served, you know, at various periods. He had been involved in the Russian Civil War as an advisor, right? So he knew what, he had an idea. He served in Eastern Europe, right? And he had an understanding of the type of violence there in terms of primarily directed against civilian population. So if the British Army were also using it, I think I'd be slow to get, as you say, I'd be very slow to kind of say that this is you know, I mean, I do put it in quotation marks because I understand from scholars who are, you know, involved in genocide studies are studying the Holocaust or looking at, you know, sort of pogroms in Eastern Europe, that of course I get the sensitivity around the term, but that doesn't mean that I put it in quotation marks because I want to use it. I understand that there are definitional debates out there, and in some ways the book doesn't enter into that because we needed another book. But I want to also, I think we need to be very careful about dismissing that use of the word, since it's a contemporaneous use of the word. It's not a word that's been invented in 1995 or something. So let's use it, given that it's used in the context by people who are extremely traumatized by what their communities went through.
At the end of this process now of writing the book and doing all the research, do you think there's any lessons that can be drawn in terms of how to police or not to police a communal violence?
Wow, yeah. I mean, it's. I think, look, we're living through a period where in the United States, you know, people are concerned about the National Guard, elements of the National Guard. I think when it comes to using reservists and part-time elements, ultimately the British Army in September 1921 got it right when they said, you have to get the Special Constabulary off the streets. You cannot have a part-time militia that's made up primarily from one community with particular political views involved in the sensitive issue of policing an intercommunal conflict. It just doesn't work. So the beast specials have to get off the streets. I think that was the correct decision. It was disastrous that the British government sort of reneged upon that and overruled Dublin Castle and the British Army on Belfast. So I think the lesson for me is we need to be the vigilance about militia and paramilitary, like, in terms of, you know, there's some fantastic recent work on paramilitarism, which I kind of draw upon myself. And, you know, it just shows the state in terms of subcontracting out to groups that are part-time, are militia, are private contractors. And this is something that can be really disastrous for the rule of law, for respect for the state, for consensual policing. You know, the Peel principles, the police of the people, the people of the police. I mean, the Peel principles were absolutely dead and 20 feet buried in Belfast in 1921-22, right? The lesson was as well for me was that the RIC, in some ways this predated this. In 1886, the way the RIC were expelled, well, forced to withdraw from parts of the Shankill Road, you know, and that was seen as this gap between the magistrates who wanted to get the special constables, you know, sworn in 1886 to basically go after nationalists who were, because there was intercommunal rioting going on, and they wanted to swear in undisciplined special constables over the objections of the RIC in West Belfast. That was a lesson in itself. There was already a lesson for the 20s there in terms of the demoralization of the RIC in Belfast, the way that loyalists felt they scored a victory over the RIC. So once the regular forces start, I think, deferring to the irregular forces or paramilitary, or they're scared of militia. And in some ways, the British Army in the 1920s are in that problematic place as well. They are noting that they are 5,000 strong. Now, they later get stronger, right, because of the Northern Offensive. So it's dealing with people who ostensibly say that they are even more loyal to the state than the regular forces. We need to be vigilant about this, because it's often, you know, today the British government regard dissident Republicans clearly as a subversive threat, right? So that's why they're on the list of, that's why they're an MI5 priority. But it's the entities that say that they are more loyal than the PSNI are, you know, that they are better part of the British state than the PSNI are. They're a better part of the state than the British, you know, they ultimately will be the deciders, the arbiters of what they believe goes in terms of the interests of the state that they say that they are part of. You know, these paramilitary elements who try and use a veto of violence or a threat of violence, this is the lesson, really. And it's a lesson we should never forget. Because once you take this genie out of the bottle, once you establish a 31,000 strong special constabulary, suddenly the British Army finds itself in a situation in 1922 where they think the price of actually clamping down on this paramilitarism. We need to remember that these guys were vetoing British policy at various points. The Collins-Craig Pact collapsed because of the escalating loyalist violence in Belfast, right? Collins switched from thinking, and Craig turned around and said, you know, because of loyalist violence, now, whether he sincerely meant this or not is open to interpretation, I cannot deliver on the Collins-Craig Pact. I cannot reform the specials. I cannot adhere to a boundary commission. So the loyalist, this veto of loyalist terrorism is an important one, and we need to remember it. And we need to be conscious that it exists today as well, because, you know, there are people on this island who believe that, you know, the one thing that will stop this island in its tracks in terms of future political choices will be the threat of or use of a terror veto by loyalist paramilitaries.
Well, Ed, that was fascinating. And we could really talk for another 2 hours on this subject. But I really appreciate you coming on today. And if everyone could check out your new book, that's Ghosts of a Family, Ireland's Most Infamous Unsolved Murder, The Outbreak of the Civil War and the Origins of the Modern Troubles.
Thanks very much.
You can find this episode and all our previous episodes on our website, irishhistoryshow.ie. You can follow us on Twitter at Irish History Pod and on Facebook, facebook.com/The Irish History Show. And please, if you get a chance, please rate and review the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. So on behalf of myself and my co-presenter, John Dorney from theirishstory.com, thank you very much for listening.
Radio.ie hosts the Irish History Show podcast because history matters. Radio turns 100 years young this year. Radio's history is powered by Radio Archives. For radio archiving solutions from people passionate about radio, visit radio.ie.